Hello, my name is Sam Chandra and this is Deep Sky. Each week we go into conversation helping you to explore and understand the uncharted waters of the intersection of artificial intelligence, aviation, and the future of humanity. As for me, I'm an airline captain, a student of artificial intelligence, and your guide to navigating the world of aviation transformed by artificial intelligence. In this episode, I have the privilege of speaking with James Howard. He is the Chief Technology Officer and co-founder of Iris Automation, a Silicon Valley-based deep tech aviation company that is harnessing the power of deep neural networks and computer vision to develop systems that can see, detect, and avoid aircraft, much like a human pilot does with their eyes. James talks about the challenges of developing classification technologies that have to recognize aircraft in flight, commonly only very faint gray and black smudges in the far distance. We also dive into the process that he is taking his company, Iris Automation, through with the regulator in order to ensure this very new technology is safe, trusted, and certified. This is Deep Sky. Thanks for coming on, James. What was your real motivation for starting Iris, and why is Cassia necessary?
Right. So the real motivation for starting Iris Automation came about through my own personal experiences in the drone industry and the experiences of my co-founder. And we had pretty much the same experience really in the work that we did, which was that drones were really cool. And we were both working for companies that had cutting edge autonomous aviation systems, but they were both limited in what they could do. And the main limitation was because of the safety aspect of flying an unmanned aircraft in the national airspace without necessarily being able to guarantee a human was going to be there to babysit that operation at all times. So that is a restriction when you want to fly a drone in a flight configuration called beyond line of sight, which basically means that the human operator no longer has visual contact with the aircraft. So that could be a long range flight, like down a pipeline or a power line, or it could be even a short range flight, but you happen to go around the corner of a building and you can no longer see the drone. And that is illegal in the United States and most other countries without getting special permissions to be able to do that. And it's been notoriously difficult to get those permissions because the first question the regulator asks is, how can you guarantee that this aircraft is not going to collide with other aircraft that are operating in the national airspace? And, you know, we very quickly realized that that was an extremely difficult, but also fundamental problem to the industry that needed to be solved for drones to expand in the way that people wanted them to, and to enable the true scalability of autonomous aircraft into industries which have traditionally been stuck on the ground, but could benefit greatly from being able to fly and gather data and transport packages and do all sorts of things from the air. And so, you know, we founded Iris Automation to solve that problem and just focus on that one thing, where we'd seen a lot of drone companies at the time when we were founding, it was sort of the hype cycle of drones, and there was all these drone companies, you know, left and right coming out of everywhere. But we sort of saw that, you know, there's probably too many companies for the industry to support, and everybody was going to face the same problem. So we thought we will solve that problem for everybody, and, you know, that will help the industry move forward. So that's how we founded Iris Automation, or why we decided to. And then it's been a journey from there over the last five and a half years about that now, in our pursuit of bringing that about and really making the airspace safer for everybody, because the future of airspace in the United States, and I think really globally, it's going to be a shared airspace between autonomous systems and unmanned systems, and maintaining the safety of that airspace is critical. And building awareness tools and autonomous safety tools to enable that future is is really going to be fundamental for everybody to participate in that future and enable all of those different activities that we want to do in the air.
And I know a bunch of the people that listen to my podcast are already in aviation. Why can't we just fly IFR everywhere instead?
I think the real key to that is that not all places in the world that you want to do things have the infrastructures to support IFR, where you know ground infrastructure is required, human resources are required, and there are rural places that need servicing from aircraft, but can only be serviced in VFR conditions because of the lack of that infrastructure. Our company has customers from the far north Alaskan tundra, you know, out to the deserts of Australia, and there's just no infrastructure there to enable IFR flight. And drones, traditionally haven't been integrated into IFR airspace because of the potential overwhelming nature of the number of aircraft that are predicted to enter the airspace. So we've really been focusing on trying to solve the problem from a different angle. It's how can you get an autonomous system to integrate with all layers and types of airspace in a way that's seamless with the existing use of that airspace.
I was talking to the CEO of Dedalion recently. You may be familiar with that company. And the way he put it, he said, because the human is the central part of the aviation system, if you can replicate that, you can put your aircraft in any part of the aviation system. And I guess detect and avoid is, one part of that central piece to the aviation system. I heard your CEO say the other day that if we are able to also have detect and avoid, you can multiply the humans in the system, i.e. multiply their efforts and operate many, many, many aircraft, which is the true promise, I think the words he used, of automation. Are you working towards enabling multiple drones being operated by one person, or is it just the detect and avoid piece you're working on right now?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think the way we sort of see it is that aviation and airspace has always been designed to be a multi-layered risk mitigation, where the pilot in the cockpit is certainly a core element of that. But in reality, they're the last line of defense. You have radios, you've got transponders, you've got ADS-B, you've got traffic control, and radars, and all sorts of different things that add layers of mitigation. And the key layer that the unmanned world has already always struggled with has been the last layer of defense, which is be in the void, basically. And that's where we want to put our products. And see in a void can take the place of many, or take many different forms. One form is a pilot in a cockpit. Another form is a visual observer on the ground. So drones are operated today with visual observers on the ground who are responsible for maintaining the safety of the airspace that drone is operating in. And one way that we can start to scale the drone industry in a safe manner is by aiding those visual observers with autonomous systems and start multiplying the number of aircraft that can be operated by a single visual observer. And that will be a process where initially, we might see two aircraft, and then a year down the road, three aircraft and four aircraft. And it's all part of a process of stepping towards a more autonomous future. Our sort of approach there is that we can enhance and be another layer in that strategy of risk mitigation, where the visual detection and avoidance can enable the scaling of autonomous systems towards that fully autonomous future.
Could you just briefly explain on a very high level how the Cassius system actually works?
So Iris Automation builds computer vision based detect and avoid systems, where we use cameras on board an aircraft to be able to see other aircraft in the airspace around us. So our premier product is called Cassia. We have multiple different configurations of Cassia, and it's essentially a small camera and compute system where we can install cameras on board the drone or on board, you know, regular aircraft or, you know, on the ground or other configurations that we're experimenting with that uses a core computer vision and deep learning system to be able to detect, range, classify, and identify another aircraft. And with that information, we can output that to the autopilot, to the ground station operator, to the pilot, and they can take actions or make decisions based on that information. And the core value of using a vision system is really that you can see any type of aircraft. There's no requirement for that aircraft to have any equipment on board for it to be detected by our system. So where ADS-B is a cooperative detection method, in the sense that different aircraft have to cooperate in the ADS-B network, vision is non-cooperative. So we can see all types of aircraft, whether they're parachutes, balloons, gliders, general aviation, you know, fun flyers, paragliders, all of these things can be seen by a vision system without any of those aircraft having to have any equipment on board. And we really take advantage of the recent leaps and in performance of computer vision systems and miniaturized compute systems to be able to offer something that's very lightweight and low power, which is critical on board autonomous systems, because the more power you use, the more weight the system is, you're reducing the performance of that aircraft, the range that it can fly or the payload that it can carry. That's one of the key benefits of vision, is that it offers a passive sensing solution. So radar and LIDAR and other sensors, they need to project energy into the environment and listen for the reflection of that energy. Whereas a vision system is using energy that's provided to us by this great big ball of burning gas in the sky in the form of light. And that really reduces the size and weight and power footprint that the vision system has on board the drone in comparison to, you know, active sensing technology.
That's a fascinating way to put it, James. You know, it's a passive sensing system. Fundamental physics of vision mean that it is a low energy system. That's why we have eyes and we don't have LIDAR as human beings, I suppose. We've got this system on board a drone that, or a manned aircraft, that detects the type of aircraft. It detects how far away it is, where it's moving, the direction it's moving in, and then it figures out what to do next. So how much of your system is the avoid system and how much of it is the detect system? Where do you focus on more in Iris?
We focus squarely on the detection side of things. That's really our bread and butter, is understanding, is there an aircraft there? And then, you know, if we think there's an aircraft there, where is it and what type of aircraft is it? And what is that aircraft doing? From there, we have a couple different options of what we can do. Our system does enable autonomous avoidance as well. Like, we have algorithms built in for that. But that's usually the way that it's integrated in a drone. Usually the autopilot is in a better position to take an avoidance maneuver than our system would be, because it has more information about the mission that has been planned, like the waypoints that it needs to travel to. It has more information about the environment that it's in terms of like the maps and other things that we use to plan the mission. And so we have two ways of integrating. Either we can use the algorithms that our system has built in and command the autopilot what to do, or we can hand that off to the autopilot and just say, hey, this is where the plane is. You should decide what is best to stay safe in this situation. And that really depends on the manufacturer of the drone and their equipment and its capabilities as to, you know, which option we will go down. The avoidance maneuver itself has quite a lot of dependency on the actual performance characteristics of the drone itself. So different styles of drone, whether they're multi-rotors or helicopters or fixed wings, they perform in different ways. And, you know, the avoidance maneuver that one style of aircraft might take may be less effective for another style of aircraft. And so, typically we will see from our customers a mix in terms of the direction that they're going, and we kind of offer both directions. But the core of our technology and the fundamental value of what Iris Automation is trying to provide to the industry is in the detection side of things, and that can take different forms, whether that's onboard a drone or not on a drone. That detection of aircraft is the critical thing.
So you're simulating the eyes and the perception, not necessarily the hands that change the autopilot, to use the human as an analogy.
I guess in the industry, we call this the concept of operations, like the CONOPS is, and that's different for every operation. If you're on a mining site and you're doing a survey on a daily basis, it's a very different operation to if you're a power company and you're flying down a power line once a month. And the way that you react to aircraft in these different CONOPS needs to be flexible based on the environment and the different layers of mitigation that you have and the different types of control and aircraft that you have in those missions.
You guys use machine learning, I understand, to develop the computer vision models. Could you explain why and how that process works?
Yeah, we use a combination of different techniques in our system, but machine learning is one of them. It's a very, very powerful tool for us to put into our system because it enables us to do things which are typically difficult for a human if you were to try to manually program an algorithm. So things like recognition tasks usually fall into that bucket, where if you want to, say, determine between a plane and a helicopter as a human, we're very capable of doing that, but trying to program an algorithm to determine the difference between a plane and a helicopter at any angle can be quite difficult.
It'd probably take you like decades, right? Like, if you actually thought about it, I don't know how many parameters does your neural network have? Like, what, a billion? No, that's too many.
I wouldn't know where we're at right now, but
it'd literally take you 100 years to make one. It's crazy, isn't it? You're using machine learning to do stuff that only humans can really do because it is so complex. But now these machines can learn by themselves. They program the code and you don't have to. You use it to recognize an aircraft at any angle and any distance?
Yeah. What we have really, I guess, pioneered on internally is on the recognition of objects at extremely small scales, where we've seen the computer vision industry has focused on high resolution imagery because everyone wants to classify stuff that you can take a picture of with a mobile phone camera. And most people can take 4K photos with the phone in their pocket these days. But we are going in another direction, which is we want to see an airplane as far away as we possibly can. And that means detecting something with as few pixels as possible. And so our algorithms are trained to recognize airplanes versus helicopters, versus other types of aircraft with like a smudge of gray and white.
I mean, I'm a pilot myself, but I fly in an airline here and I know how hard it is to see anything. I think about the days when I used to fly VFR. How is this legal? Like, how are we looking at airplanes outside and being like, that is the way that we're not going to crash? It just doesn't make any sense. That's fascinating. Low resolution image recognition. You're not classifying cats or faces like Facebook is. You're classifying these tiny, as you said, tiny little smudges of something that's moving in the distance with hazy skies and a moving aircraft, both of them. How do you do that?
That is the secret sauce of Iris Automation. I kind of alluded to it before, which is that we use a whole combination of different things. We're using classical computer vision geometric algorithms. We're using machine learning and deep learning in different ways and in different pieces of our system. And we're combining them all together to do this one thing. And we face all sorts of challenges. Like one algorithm might be tricked by a cloud. And so then you have to, build another algorithm to figure out like what's a cloud and what's not a cloud. And you know, you put all of these things together and build the brains of Cassia, which is the aircraft detection system, and then train that on thousands and thousands and thousands of different situations from the real world, and then scale that up to millions and millions and millions in simulation. And that's really how you do it. You have to try and see as many different environments as you possibly can and make something that is truly robust. So we fly drones at airplanes every day. We have pilots on our team and drone pilots on our team. And we own an aircraft, we rent aircraft, and we literally fly them at each other and, you know, pretend like they're going to collide. And that's part of how we train our system. We do that in different environments, different locations, different times of day, different angles of incidents. We gather all of this data, and then we take that and put it into a simulation system, which we have built in-house. And then we tell that simulator, hey, from all of this, what are the gaps in our data set? And can you please generate randomized data that fills our gaps and tests our system in ways that we've never seen in the real world? And by doing this, we can get a really good classification of how our system is performing. What is the likelihood of detection? What's the detection range? What's the, you know, different angles of aircraft and things that we can detect in different environments, and haze and weather and altitudes, times of day? Like there's so many variables you could throw into this, and it gets really complicated really quickly. But really the fundamental part of it is just trying to build as robust a system as you can. And that means you need as much data as you can get from as wide a variety of situations. You know, that's why, you know, you see every sort of startup that's, or not just startups, but big companies that are doing AI and computer vision systems with massive, massive data sets. And that is really what enables you to be able to build these kinds of systems.
How do you separate your training and testing set?
That's really fundamental. You can't train something, a certain set of data, and then test it on the same set of data, because it just learns the patterns in that data. And then you give it something new and it's like, oh, I've never seen that before. I don't know what to do. It's kind of like cramming for an exam. You can memorize all that stuff, but then you get hit with something that you've never expected, that, you know, wasn't in your cram papers, and you can't answer the question. We have internal data management tools that we've developed that allow us to separate the data that we're training on and that we're testing on. You know, that's part of our due diligence in working with global regulators. There's a lot of focus on what we're doing internally, like not only how our systems work, but how did we build them? How did we test them? How did we manage the data? How did we manage the code and the versioning and the way that we developed that code? All of that goes into what makes our final product. Often with startups, you know, in this kind of space, the end result is what's flashy and important to talk about, but what goes into it is so much more, because you need to back all of that up. When you're building a safety system, it's critical to dive into every element you can and prove what is happening and why, and prove why you understand that as well. There's kind of like a meta game that you have to play, but it's not just the outcome. It's also how you reach that outcome.
And I think the technical term for the meta game is the design assurance process, if I'm...
Yes.
I understand the levels of design assurance required for traditional software in manned aviation. There is a lot of work going on, as far as I understand, how deep learned neural networks can be operationalized in the manned aviation space. How is it different, perhaps, for drones? What sort of design assurance process does the FAA, EASA, CASA want to see you go through, and how does it differ to the manned aviation process?
That is a key question that the whole industry, you know, is sort of grappling with at the moment, I think. The real difference in the design assurance process between, you know, one type of aircraft and another is that aircraft carrying passengers? When you want to carry a passenger, you get into a whole lot of extra design assurance that you need to go through. And then when you take the passengers out, things become a lot more, you know, easy to do. I say easy to do, but it's still extremely difficult. It's kind of hard because a lot of this stuff is so new. And so you can't just point to the decades of aviation history that we have, or, you know, centuries of aviation history, and say, you know, this is how we do it. We can certainly take all of our lessons from that. They're hard-earned lessons, as, you know, many aviators can attest to, and apply that into the autonomous aviation space. But there's also a lot of new stuff that we need to invent from the ground up in terms of procedures and practices and standards and regulations. I think the industry, they're still developing that. It's going to take, you know, several more years yet before things start to stabilize in terms of regulations and requirements. But that's something that we, as part of the industry, engage very actively on. So we work with governments and government agencies like CASA, EASA, and the FAA, and Transport Canada, and many others, to actually inform them on the development of these regulations and the development of the standards which they, you know, will hold as necessary for doing certain things. When it comes to AI and deep learning systems, it's an evolving landscape. There are several standards that are either released or close to being released that address some of the issues with artificial intelligence systems.
You work in the space of under 25 kilograms, 55 pounds. Right now, 2021, what hurdles do you have to pass to have your system sitting on a drone and the FAA says, go for it?
The biggest hurdle really is flight testing data. And it's not just like, hey, go out there and get 5,000 hours of the same thing, because that's not a very good representative test of your system. And so we have worked very closely with the FAA and with standards bodies to define an actual testing process that we have to go through. And so that includes specific flight test data, but it also includes information on everything that I was talking about, like our design process, our development process, our testing process, et cetera, et cetera. And we produce this giant document with a manifest of all of this information and explaining it all. And you know, that's sort of part of how we work with the regulator today. That process is evolving and standardizing over time. As the regulator learns more, as we learn more, and as the standards bodies learn more. And what we sort of see as the future is that the processes for doing these things will become standardized, such that it's a published document. Anyone can reference that and say, you know, this is the procedure that needs to be gone through to be able to get a computer vision or artificial intelligence system to be approved for flight. And at the moment, an approval means that you are getting a waiver of exemption from the existing rules. Long term, the procedures will be standardized such that it's the same as, you know, any other rule for flying. It says, if you meet this, and this criteria, you can do these things. And that's really the future that we want to work towards with the government, standard bodies, the rest of the industry, to help define that process. So right now it's still evolving, and we have to go through all this due diligence in a lot more of a manual fashion. And just be really, really open about how our system is functioning. And we can't hide anything. If there's any problem that we think our system might have, that goes in that report. And we say to them, like, we know of this problem and we don't have a solution yet, but we need you to know that that is there. And that's what the FAA and other governments want to see, because they don't build computer vision systems. They don't build AI, like, train deep neural nets and stuff. So they need the industry to be open with them. And, you know, that's not something we should be scared about, because that informs the rulemaking. That helps accelerate the adoption of autonomous systems, is by being open and honest with the regulator, not just about the good stuff, but also about the bad stuff.
So you're writing the regulations as we speak with the regulators?
Yeah, like, we're not writing the words that go on the page, but, you know, when they want to know something about how does a computer vision system work on a drone, like, we are, you know, the leading manufacturer of onboard detect and avoid systems, and we can really inform them onto, like, how do these things work. And equally so, the FAA can inform us on gaps they see in what we're doing and, you know, comb through our data and say, you know, you need to improve this or what about this thing? And it's a back and forth. So, and that's really what we like to see is that kind of collaboration.
Mm. And certification is something that's given when the thing is safe. Certification isn't necessarily a bunch of hoops you've got to jump through to get the thing flying. When will you know that your system is safe?
That is a really good question. I think the key thing to understand, or at least the way that I think about it, is certification is the government agreeing that the thing that you're selling does what you say it does, as opposed to saying, you know, this is safe to do whatever the hell you want with it. You know, the process that we are going through is trying to get to a point where the FAA agrees to say, yes, the specifications of your system, of its performance, in the limitations that you've provided for its performance, are true and accurate. So, you know, if we say we have this percentage of detection given these environmental limitations, like that, and then we get a stamp to say, like, yes, that is true, and it is tested, and we have looked at your data and verified it. So it's not necessarily about saying, is the system safe or not? It's about saying, you know, are the claims true and have they been tested thoroughly? And does the data support those claims? And I guess the trick with drone safety systems right now is there's not really a true path to say, hey, this detect and avoid is certified by the FAA. But the closest thing we have to that at the moment is to have the FAA approve a waiver of exemption to allow us to fly with the use of our detect and avoid system as a mitigating factor for air risk. And we've achieved several of those over the last few years in different situations. And it's our ability to prove our claims which allows us to be able to do that.
Right. And the way that your system fits into the overall aviation safety system, you're not saying, put our system on board and you'll never crash. You're saying, currently we have human observers trying to find smudges in the sky. Put our system on board and you'll have this deep neural network training computer vision, especially for this task, and you'll probably pick up double, triple, quadruple the number of aircraft and avoid them more effectively than what you can now. That's your promise, right?
Yeah, we don't guarantee you can go and do whatever you want if you put our system on board your drone. It is a layer of risk mitigation in an operation,
yeah.
And it has, you know, many, many advantages. Like you mentioned, we've had instances where people who use our system have been happily flying their drone around, and they're wondering why is it? It just avoided and it's descending. Why is it descending? And then 10 seconds later, a helicopter roars over that they couldn't hear because there was like a big line of trees or a building or something blocking their view and, you know, blocking their ability to hear the engine or something. And they're like, wow, like this is what this thing does.
Mind blown.
That's what it's for. Yeah, it really is a mind blowing situation because we've had people call us and be like, I was just shocked.
You said it would do the thing and it did the thing. Oh my goodness. Yeah, that must be very encouraging as a CTO and a co-founder to have someone call you and go, dude, it works.
Yeah, it's incredibly validating. Like, it has been a long, very difficult journey to get to this point. And, you know, we're still on that journey. It's not, you know, we haven't tied up our products and said that they're good. Like, we're constantly releasing software updates. We're constantly testing. We're constantly, you know, working on new things and proving out new capabilities in new environments. And it will continue to be that way into the foreseeable future. But it's really validating to see that, you know, what it can do now, it can really do it. And there's people out there using it to do that stuff.
Yeah, that's
that's really what we want.
Do you have in-service monitoring systems to see if your neural networks are doing what they're supposed to do in real life, in the real product?
Right. So we have systems on board which can detect anomalous situations or basically like environmental data which we don't expect for some reason, or where we think our system is behaving oddly. And so we can log and flag that data, which we can then get back from our customers, uploaded to our system, our data management system in the back end. We can have a look at that data and say, like, you know, was this actually anomalous, or, you know, was it some other environmental factor, or, you know, what was it that triggered this logging of this data, and then use that data to help improve the system. So all of our products that are out there, they can log this data and upload it back to us. And they're not just logging the data that they think is anomalous in some way. They will also log a whole host of what we call null data, which is just random. You're flying around and nothing appears to be happening. Because I guess one of the key things of autonomous systems, and I think this really just goes for anything in life, is that you have built something and tested it in certain environments, but you don't really know how it's going to respond in environments that you haven't tested. And it's sometimes very difficult to represent everything that could possibly happen in a laboratory setting. And so it's really important to be gathering back data in situations where you actually don't think anything anomalous would happen, because there might be something about that situation that is odd or is unique and that you have never seen before, and that could inform very important design decisions.
So the data comes back to Iris. You do version 1+1, whatever the next version of the software. And what do you have to do before you send that back out to your drones in the field? Is there another process that you go through to test it again?
Yeah, we go through a really rigorous test process. So, you know, you do all of your standard software development stuff, your different levels of testing that are fully automated, your integration test, unit test, build test, regression. Like, there's all this stuff that I think lots of folks in the software industry are very familiar with. But then we get into what's the drone specific stuff? What's the safety and aviation specific stuff? So, you know, we go through real world flight testing, where we have a whole host of different aircraft here that we can put our system on that has different types of autopilots, different physical configurations, you know, multi-rotors and fixed wings and helicopters and all sorts of different types. And we'll go out and we will fly every configuration that we can think of that practical and useful for us to fly, and gather all of that data, analyze that data, and make sure that our system was behaving the way that we expected it to behave during that flight testing campaign. And that just is what we do to validate our software release. But then once the software is released, we want to characterize the full behavior of that software. And that's what informs really the regulator, is what have you done to like characterize the behavior beyond just making sure that the software is working the way you expect. So we go through a process of simulating millions and millions of different encounters between drones and airplanes in our simulation environment. And we go through a whole host of additional flight testing specifically targeted to testing the weaknesses of our system so that we can fully characterize its behavior.
And this is every time you have a software update?
Yeah.
Not quite Facebook, hey?
Not quite click a button, automated test, and bam, it's live. It needs to be, you know, fully determined to be safe. And you know, we want to stand behind that product and that software release. And it's a difficult process for us, but it's a necessary one. I guess like the really critical difference between making an aviation product and say building some other deep learning system, you know, like an app which can classify photographs of cats or whatever, you know, to build on your previous example. But you know, it doesn't really matter if that thing fails. You know, if that app crashed, the user just boots it back up and like tries again.
They found a dog. Yeah.
If our system fails, there is the potential, like during the period that it's resetting from its failure, that something occurs that our system should have protected against. And that, you know, that even the failure of our system is taken into account when we are making claims about its performance. If we are aware of certain things that fail in certain environments, that goes into the overall ability of our system to mitigate risk. So at the end of the day, you have some percentage that says, this is the percent that we mitigate risk within this environment. And it's the success of the system, but also the failure of the system, which goes into calculating that percentage.
That's fascinating. Thanks very much for entertaining me and diving into the more technical, not necessarily technical, but technical details on how you make it work really well. Probably the last main question is how far along the platform / certification chain do you want to bring your detect and avoid technology, i.e. Bring it into the IMEASA, the certified category for UAS, so bring it into much larger UAS and also manned aircraft. How far up do you want to take your company?
We want to go as far as we can. Our mandate is to make flying safer with autonomous systems. And that doesn't just mean drones only, right? And putting our system on board a drone. Making flying safer through autonomy also has implications in the cockpit for, you know, traditionally piloted aircraft, on the ground for a variety of different missions. And the core of our technology is the detection of other aircraft. And that detection can then enable a whole host of different behaviors to enhance the safety of flight. So we want to take the technology, you know, across the aviation industry. If I see the future of IRIS in 5 to 10 years, like, we will definitely have more products than those that we have now for the drone space, that I really hope will bring the capabilities of our technology to enhance the safety of aviation in many different ways.
So coming to a Cessna 152 near you.
One day.
Oh, that'd be cool to see. One more question. What's the one thing that operators should know for the next 5 to 10 years that you know?
What is our secret inside knowledge of the industry? A couple of years ago, or, you know, certainly around the period when our company was being founded, the drone hype cycle was in full swing. And everyone thought, you know, in a few years, I'll be getting Amazon delivering stuff to my home with a drone. I think the secret to building a sustainable business in the drone industry and understanding the future of autonomy in aviation is that this process will take time, and that is okay. And in fact, that is good, because in that process of due diligence that regulators are taking and that, you know, engineers are involved in and continually improving systems, we will have a very safe and robust airspace system around the world with the integration of autonomy to do everything we want, you know, without having to sacrifice the safety and the freedoms that we enjoy today as aviators. And that is very important. So I think, you know, the key is really just to engage in the process that the world is going through right now of development of autonomous systems and integration of those systems into the airspace. And, you know, be aware that that process will take time, and that you should, at the same time, like, that doesn't mean that we stop pushing, right? We're always pushing forward and always on the cutting edge, but we need to do that development in a way that works with everybody who uses the global airspace.
And I think making it safe is cutting edge. That is on the cutting edge. I don't see a whole lot of ultra safe, responsible, ethical AI being put out there, at least in the consumer space right now. So I think what you're doing is cutting edge, even though it takes a lot longer than perhaps the common conception in the tech world. So yeah, thanks for what you're doing, James. Thanks very much for this chat. we have thoroughly enjoyed listening.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure to be here.
And that does conclude another episode. It's been a pleasure to have you listening. If you are interested in the work that James and his company, Iris Automation, are doing, please be sure to check out the show notes for the link to his website. If you have any questions about the future of AI in aviation, or would like to have a chat about how AI may impact your business or career in the future, then please send me an email at samuel.chandra01@gmail.com. The email address is in the show notes. Please do come back next week for another engaging conversation. This is Deep Sky.